Welcome to SCI Science Perspectives, a podcast brought to you by the American Spinal Injury Association. In this podcast, we'll be discussing emerging literature spanning the full spectrum of SCI research, from discovery to clinical application. You're listening to a Scholarly Perspectives episode with Dr. Sina Sangari. I'm David.
And I'm Marla. And today we will be discussing the paper, Spasticity Predicts Motor Recovery for Patients with Subacute Motor Complete Spinal Cord Injury, published in the journal Annals of Neurology. Dr. Sina Sangari received his Master of Science and PhD degrees in neuroscience from University Pierre and Marie Curie in Paris, France. His experiences have provided him with ample expertise in neurophysiology of the sensory motor system in humans. His research interests focus on fundamental research and methodological development of sensory motor integration at cortical, subcortical, and spinal levels in humans with and without motor control disability. He trained with Professor Véronique Marchand-Poivre to investigate the neuromechanisms contributing to motor control in humans with and without amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. He is currently working with Professor Monica Perez to investigate the contribution of descending motor pathways in spasticity and recovery in humans with spinal cord injury. Welcome, Dr. Sangari.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, you know, when both Dave and I were reading through this paper, one of the things we first discussed was, you know, we have all these tools in clinical spinal cord injury that we use to help discuss prognosis with patients. You know, we use the AIS grading scale. We, you know, include discussions about motor complete versus incomplete injuries. You know, you mentioned also in your paper how now we're able to use a lot of the imaging and characteristics that we see. And so we just wanted to discuss why your group felt that it was important to find another tool to investigate prognosis and why you felt like spasticity would be a good place to start.
So this is a story that I started since I did my PhD. So this is something that was initially like starting by Professor Dimitri Jelic, that found that some people that have motor complete injury that have the ability to produce voluntary movement below the injury. Among these people, there is a part that are actually able to have some corticospinal control into this muscle below the injury. After doing some reinforcement maneuver, doing some resistance maneuver. And he described these people as not really complete, not really incomplete, but in between. So they defined that as discomplete. And what we wanted to know is actually what makes people with motor complete injury having some residual connectivity from the brain to the muscle below the level of the injury. So what we found back in the first study was that people with motor complete injuries, so classified as AES, A and B, so without any ability to do voluntary motor function below the level of the injury, some of these people have spasticity, some of these people do not have spasticity. And actually, there is a portion of about 60 to 70% of these people who have spasticity. And what we found is that when we are applying a magnetic brain stimulation to assess the connectivity from the brain through the level of the injury to this muscle, we found that we were able to evoke some motor evoke response below the level of the injury in those people who have spasticity, but not in those people without spasticity. And also we did an MRI study in parallel, and we found that atrophy of the spinal cord was less, very less atrophy of the spinal cord in these people who have spasticity and also residual motor connectivity with the global injury. So from this, we found that, this is maybe the reason that these people have do not have voluntary function, but still have residual connectivity. And this is why they have also spasticity. Just like this would show the presence of residual connectivity to this muscle. We went also a little bit further to understand the pattern between spasticity in different muscles in the one limb and also this residual connectivity. And here also we found that there is a concomitant pattern between the presence of plasticity, presence of poor joint connectivity in Siskelian people without motor function being available. And so based on that, we were thinking like, okay, maybe instead of doing the magnetic brain stimulation, we can also maybe just by doing the clinical assessment with the MAS modification scan, testing the presence of plasticity in this muscle, and we can say, oh, maybe this person with a complete motor complete injury will belong to the group with residual connectivity or will belong to the group without or residual connectivity. So all of these studies were done in people with chronic injury. So it means like they are already the injury since a long time. Some of the plasticity already are held in the body, but we can still see this residual connectivity in the connection to the brain to the muscle. So we were thinking like maybe if we go to a population that is like close to the injury, like subacute injury, maybe this will help break it. Who are the people that maybe may have more possibility of recovery compared to other, still into the group of people with a much of complete injury. And that's why in this study, like the paper that we are talking about, we look into like population of people with motor complete injury, but also motor incomplete injury, with or without spasticity or GA1 muscle. And we assess, we investigated if the presence of spasticity may predict the motor recovery during the inpatient rehabilitation from the admission to the discharge. So what about we during like this period of admit our rehabilitation, we assess from the admission and at discharge, so different parameters, so the spasticity in the lower limb muscle by using the modified HMO scale. We use also a more objective assessment of spasticity by using the pendulum test. We assess the residual connectivity with the magnetic brain stimulation. And in parallel, we get also all of the clinical assessment with P exam and the AGI assessment to get an idea of the severity of the injury and also the motor and the score below the level of the injury based on this exam. So below the neurological level of the injury. And we measure that not addition on at this charge.
Can you set the stage a little bit more for us here? So at admission, you show that MEP, for the listeners, if you hear us say that's motor evoked potential. That's the TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation, that Dr. Sankar is talking about here. Of the complete, quote unquote, I'm putting those in air quotes, and you do put that in inverted commas in the paper once, which I think is great. 42% of people with a complete injury at admission have a positive MEP response. So there's some detectable signal that can get through. So and 100% of incomplete. So for our colleagues that maybe haven't worked with MET before or TMS, but they get these patients and, you know, maybe they would use some terms like, oh, you have a severed spine, or God forbid they use the term transection. Can you talk a little about MEP and what that means?
So the MEP, as you said, like the motor evoked potential evoked by the transcranial magnetic stimulation will allow to assess the integrity of the corticospinal tract, so maybe from the brain through the spinal cord to the targeted muscle. So usually when we have like a presence of MAP response, means like there is like some residual pathway, descending motor pathway that where the descending body can go through to the muscle and get the response. And usually when you don't get the response, so there is multiple reason for not getting a reason, but we'd say like after a spinal cord injury, it would be because the injury, based on the severity of the injury, there is no much pathway that will go by the body to go through the muscle. The thing is like, as you said also, considering that it's motor complete injury doesn't mean that there is a complete section of the spinal cord. It's never, like almost never, a transection of the spinal cord. So there is always some residual tissue that remain into the central nervous system. And there is like several studies that show that with postmortem analysis, or also like MRI analysis, that there is still some tissue that remains. So what we do with the magnetic brain stimulation is trying to assess this residual tissue to get a response in the muscle. So Having a response means like there is for sure some residual connection that remains. Not having a response doesn't mean that there is no residual connection. Maybe there is less than in the other population. So that's why we are not able to detect this this response. And this is something that we show also by using like the magnetic brain stimulation inside, but also to use the spinal cord stimulation at the resting cable. And the thing is that we found that by using direct stimulation and a cord compared to magnetic brain stimulation, we get a bit more sensitivity to detect this residual connection. So it means like even with the brain, because of reorganization, plasticity, might be a bit difficult to get the response with the magnetic brain stimulation, and it is easier with the electrical stimulation.
So when talking about the like initial setup of the study, I found it interesting from a clinical perspective that you guys chose to the timeline of when somebody was in acute rehab. So obviously it's very convenient, you know, from a clinical standpoint to, you know, do this examination when you have access to all of this, you know, technology and everything, as well as the time when the person is in the rehabilitation setting at admission and then again at discharge. Can you talk about any other reasons why you guys chose that specific kind of subacute timeline to investigate the spasticity and to investigate, you know, AIS conversion and motor recovery?
So I think that our idea was here to try to implement this assessment in a clinical environment. And so knowing that like anyone in clinics can do it, not only researcher, but also a physician and all of the clinical team. The thing is like, postcranial magnetic stimulation is not a difficult technique, but it's it has a cost, and you need to have like one of the device, you need to have also the knowledge to use it. So that's why by using like the spasticity as one of the clinical assessment to assess this presence of residual connectivity, we said like it's going to be easier for the clinical team to use that instead of using the TMS. And also it's going to be very simple to say, oh, you have spasticity in your muscles, in your legs. You may have residual connectivity, so you may have some ability of recovery compared to some people who have spasticity. And so this was the reason and the timeline of about like people during their rehab, during inpatient rehabilitation, was to facilitate this translation from our research to our clinical environment. Like if we can detect that within the months, about the months that our inpatients are in rehabilitation, means like whoever like in a clinical team that would like to see if someone with a motor complaint injury may have some recovery ability, they can test that during the same period.
Yeah, that's great. It's to repeat to the listeners, 32 and 23 days post-injury was baseline, and 58 to 52 was the discharge or the post measurement. If you had a magic wand though, and this is kind of convenient, right? This is just like based on like the policy of the hospital and the insurance, et cetera, if you had a magic wand and you could just take any time point you want, like based on your knowledge of the natural history of the development of the secondary insult post-injury, when would you take these measurements?
That's a very question. It's hard to say because I would say like because everything is related, so the study is mainly related to the presence of spasticity. I would say like a critical question is when we detect spasticity, and the thing is like if it's we don't know if it's going too early after the injury, is going to be a good moment and will be not too late also because after a trip like being too late after the injury, there is also some mechanism that occurs. So the thing is like because of spasticity, there is that the spinal shock that happened after the injury where like patient lose reflexes, they may lose also function, and like progressively they will regain reflexes, they will regain some people's function. And over the course of this spinal shock, there is also spasticity that appear at the end. Usually this dramatic to spinal shock is when spasticity appears. So what was important in our study is to be sure that When we do the measurement of spasticity at a time point, we are sure to be out of the solution. We show that if we classify someone without spasticity, it's because he's not going to develop spasticity and more because he's still within the spinal shock field. So in this case, I would say like doing the measurement a bit later after the injury would be good. And this is something that we also found, because when we assess people, we did several testing over like the first week after the admission to be sure that if people were having spasticity, that was okay. Not that they belong to the group of people with spasticity, but if they were not having spasticity, we will multiply the assessments over like 1-2 weeks to be sure that spasticity is not present. So in some people, spasticity was not present, but in some people, they got the time to develop spasticity over like a week to express it. So I would say here, the admission measurement that we have done at like 32 days, like a month after the injury, is maybe like the time point that is good to assess people with motor complex and open injury to be sure that they are almost to be sure to be out of the spinal shock, to be sure that if they have spasticity, it's present, and if they do not have spasticity, it means that they are not going to develop spasticity over time.
Yeah, that's great. I often hear our inpatient physiatrists say, 4 to 8 weeks, 4 to 8 weeks. So it's cool to see that your data is kind of overlapping with that. Okay, so I'm going to restate the primary hypothesis of the paper, and then if you can just drive home the primary finding, because I think this is super important for everyone to understand the implications here. So the primary hypothesis was that motor complete in the subacute phase, someone with a motor complete, that's based on Iszynski ABCD injury with spasticity would show greater recovery. So can you talk a little bit about that primary hypothesis?
So based on one of the study that I talked to you just earlier, so we found that you have spasticity, you have presence of residual connectivity in people with chronic motor complete injury. So this residual connectivity is the substrate for the recovery, because if you can have like some connection from your brain to your muscle building of your injury, and you have signal that can go through this muscle pathway, it means like it's physiologically present. And the question is like, if it's physiological, it means like at some point it can be used also to do some contraction of the muscle below the level of the injury. So in a subacute, at the subacute phase, it will be the same thing. It's like we can detect the spasticity and the presence of residual connectivity. This will mean that there is connection from the brain to the muscle below the level of the injury. And this might be used as a substrate for recovery. So this would be really like the base to have a recovery. Neurological recovery, that's for recovery, would be at some level.
Yeah, and for the listeners, if you are reading through the paper and you get to the portion on correlations, the correlation between MAS and MEP is an R of 0.9. So this implies what? Okay, I'll reframe the question. Do we need MEP in the clinic?
Do you need MEP?
MEP, sorry, MEP, the TMS. Do we need it, or is spasticity alone enough?
I think spasticity is by itself is already good, and it will make easier to implement this in a clinical environment. Now, of course, if you have MEP, it will have a double confirmation. But from all of the previous study and this study, I think just to have a clinical assessment of spasticity is strong enough to say that you have residual connectivity.
And in motor incomplete, the term that's used throughout the paper often is regardless of presence of spasticity. And so there's a little bit of a binary being done here. And I think it's because MEP is treated as either a binary or an ordinal, can't remember, variable. But do you think there's still some prognostic value to spasticity and motor incomplete?
Yeah, I mean, at our study, we didn't find, because like the people without spasticity and motor incomplete injury, they always show some neurological recovery. And at this point, I mean, like having spasticity didn't change anything. All of these people also got motor potential but increase over the time of rehabilitation, admission to discharge, meaning that they get like strength into the descending connection from the brain to the muscle with the overall injury. But here we didn't find really like a prognostic band about spasticity. At the opposite of people with motor complete injury, where only people with spasticity and residual connectivity show some neurological recovery compared to people with spasticity.
So would you say that more spasticity is better, or is it just yes, spasticity or no, and that's what you're looking for?
So I think it's a very important question. I don't think we have really an answer here, because when we measure spasticity from admission and discharge, we didn't find like a difference. We didn't find a significant difference, an increase of spasticity with the clinical assessment with the motivational scale, but also with the objective assessment of the pendulum pulse. So both we show that severity of spasticity was the same. So it's tempting, very tempting to say like you have more spasticity, you're going to get more recovery. But at this point, we didn't find really a difference. Or I would say it's more like you have spasticity and you have recovery. And it's going to be also hard to say like how much recovery you will have at this point. And there is multiple factors that can influence this recovery.
Yeah, and the implications of this now, moving away from the, you know, clinical prognostic value, which is so important in this paper, but the implications for a more basic neurophysiological understanding of the role that residual descending signals have on spasticity. Do any of the results from this paper help us with a deeper understanding?
Yes, I mean, I think the idea also is like to include a bit more people with motor, like more severe injury into rehabilitation, because rehabilitation is like, I would say that people with motor incomplete injury, they are going through different rehabilitation strategies to improve the function below the level of the injury. But for people who have like motor complete injury, usually the strategy here is more like to reinforce the function above the level of the injury to help with independence when they are like discharging from the hospital. So if here we can identify people with motor complete injury that may have more recovery, maybe we can also strengthen this residual connection, this residual pathway to get them maybe like, I mean, some improvement, not only above the level of the injury, but also below the level of the injury. So maybe to open a bit more rehabilitation to this population of severe injury.
Yeah, I think that last, you guys talk a lot about this in a little section at the end of the paper, and I think it's so interesting because I think we have this sort of preconceived notion as to what spasticity is, what it indicates. Do you think there's any further like way to make this connection, to investigate whether, you know, more about these descending pathways and exactly what they have to do with the spasticity? Or, you know, what are the next steps if you, you know, got back into your crystal ball magic wand that Dave asked about before?
So I think there is a lot of things to do, but especially with people with motor complete injury, but I would say like, technically, it's also limiting into the investigation that we can do, especially to understand which pathways are involved and how we can act on this pathway to get people better, also to improve their function. I mean, what we found in people with motor incomplete injury, we try to understand a bit more like the involvement of different descending motor pathways, such as like the corticospinal pathway, but also the reticulospinal pathway, to understand how these two descending motor pathway can influence the spasticity. And we found that in people with motor incomplete injury and spasticity, there is some kind of imbalance contribution or imbalance influence from the corticospinal and the reticulospinal pathway in people who have spasticity. So I would say it's maybe the same thing in people with motor complete injury, but this needs further investigation. We need to confirm that. But we might think that during that plasticity mechanism that occurs after the injury, there is some compensation from this descending motor pathway, maybe also other descending motor pathway. that may explain the presence of spasticity and might explain also this residual connection connectivity. So then the question is like, which one is it? How can we target that for improving the rehabilitation? And I would say that at the very end, improving recovery of muscle function.
Absolutely, we couldn't agree more. So as a outro question here, can you tell us how you would like for our spinal cord injury colleagues to use the findings of this paper?
That's a good, very good question. I think that what I did here, I mean, the MP exam, the Asia exam are like the standard use of clinical environment for certifying for people with spinal cord injury, but also to predict the recovery. And I mean, there is no discussion about like how useful it is, because most of the clinical assessments are based on that and based on the severity of injury, the level of the oncological level of the injury, and the scoring of the muscle group of the injury. They can predict what the people that may recover, how well the people that may convert to ASIA. Great. I think here is just to provide another tool in complement to what the clinical tables use with INSCAPE 1 on the Asia, just something to go a little bit more further in detail about who are the people that can also benefit from rehabilitation on recovery within the people that already assessed by INSCAPE. So I would say it's not something that will replace, it's something that will work constantly with the INSCAPE exam to go further into detection of residual connectivity and to detect people that may benefit from some rehabilitation procedure compared to like using only the INSCAPE exam.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Sangari, for being here with us. This is a really incredible paper. You guys are, I think, really getting close to something that's going to change clinical practice and change how we talk to our patients, which, you know, from a clinician is really, you know, you're hitting all the high spots for us. So it's a very exciting topic that you all are investigating, and we really appreciate you being here to tell us firsthand more about it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCI Science Perspectives, brought to you by the American Spinal Injury Association. The topic of this episode was suggested to us by Asia's Early Career Committee. The podcast is made possible by the leadership of Dr. Suzanne Groh, your producer hosts David McMillan and Marla Petrillo, our editor Abby Fox, production assistant James Concepson, and Asia's front office. If you have any comments, questions, or concerns, please contact us at sciperspectivespodcast@gmail.com.